Welcome to AIB Bank. Please note that your call may be recorded for training or quality purposes. Please choose from one of the following options.
Hello, Connor speaking.
Hey, Connor, it's Francesca. I'm just giving you a shout to see what's the latest with the Belfry appeals.
Hi, Francesca. Look, unfortunately, it still remains an extremely painful and frustrating position for people. There are 500,000 to 600,000.
Between 2001 and 2006, AIB, one of the country's biggest banks, sold a series of funds to more than 2,500 individual investors. They were branded as the Belfry Funds. The numbers and the ambition were startling. AIB raised in the region of €300 million and channeled it into UK commercial property deals, first in major cities like London and Manchester, and later in smaller regional centres like Birmingham and Bradford. Belfry One was a runaway success. Investors saw returns as high as 250%. But Belfry Funds 2 to 6 tanked. Thousands of investors were left with nothing. From Currency Media, I'm Francesca Cumman, and this is the story of Belfry. It's the story of how ordinary investors were drawn into a complex property scheme.
At the time, I kind of said, look, I was a big buy. You know, it was put in front of me. Nobody had put a gun to my head.
How many lost their pensions and life savings?
He's working to this day. My husband is working to this. He's 80, and he's working to this day.
Some borrowed heavily to buy into a scheme they now claim was missold to them by the bank.
The 150,000, it was as if I got it for an expensive car, you know, that I crashed up.
In this two-part series, we examine why investors put their trust and their money into Belfry. We explain how and why it all unravelled. And we investigate why, two decades later, many are still fighting to get their money back. You'll hear from the investors who got burnt.
You'll see big bonuses paid to the management now after the AGM. And the two fingers up to the investors.
From the legal and financial advisors that helped them bring their fight all the way to the Supreme Court.
I felt, in very, very simplistic terms, I felt that the case because they were missold an investment.
And you'll hear why that fight is far from over.
Two brothers, same night, same kitchen, same paperwork. One gets refunded, one doesn't.
In fact, the only people you're not going to hear from is AIB. It declined to be interviewed for this investigation. In many ways, the story of Belfry is more than the story of a failed investment scheme. It's a story of its time. It's the story of Ireland. Hey, yeah, Ken.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good morning.
This is your salad.
You?
Nice to meet you.
Great.
That's Ken Hannigan.
This is my little bowl.
Ken is a hairdresser.
It's lovely.
And we're at the hair store salon in Moynalty in County Meath.
Hiya. How are you?
Good. Not all hairdressers are born raconteurs.
Nice to meet you.
Ken is naturally chatty, the kind of person who puts you at your ease the minute you walk in the door. And that usually is a good thing.
Yeah, it's probably very pure, is it?
Except around 20 years ago, Ken, who's originally from Dublin, decided to start his life afresh. He sold a salon business and moved with his wife Anne and their kids to Alicante in Spain. It was a dream move. Then he struck up a conversation and made an investment that would change everything. That investment was with AIB Bank, and it was called the Belfry Fund.
When we originally moved to Spain, our bank manager, who became friends with us, was on the inspection trip that we went over, and we bought an apartment. He was at one, we were neighbours. And from there, we became friends. And over a period of days out, having a few meals and a few drinks, he spoke to me about the Belfry.
Ken had money on deposit, something he believes his bank manager must have known about when he advised him to buy into the UK Property Fund, then in its fifth year.
The Belfry was 1, 2, 3 and 4 was doing very well. And he said, get into this. This is a no-brainer. If I had the money myself, I would buy into it. And as he had said to me, his pitch was that many staff from the bank and colleagues of his have bought into it. There was no risk, high risk involved, and I trusted him impeccably.
Ken wasn't alone. AIB customers around Ireland were hearing the same pitch.
We started our business in 1978, my husband and I, and all we ever did was work, 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 and pensions We were young and pensions never. And anyway, the company, we went through the 80s, struggled through the 80s. Company never had money to invest in our pension fund. Gave us all we could do to pay the staff.
June Duggan and her husband Bernard are behind Duggan Systems in Limerick. It's a successful glazing business. Now run by their son John, the company provides facades for high-rise commercial buildings like the Euronext Stock Exchange and the Guinness Brewhouse at St James's Gate. It wasn't always that way. The couple started off doing smaller jobs, mainly domestic work. But by 2005, Bernard had turned 60 and business, just like the economy, was good. As lifelong AIB customers, the couple engaged Goodbody Stockbrokers, owned by AIB, to manage their pension.
This guy, whose name I can't remember and has been, they've all been redacted, very nice guy, came up and started investments. Then one day I got a phone call to say, well, could he bring somebody else with him?
The two men came to the couple's house in Adair to talk about the Belfry. June can't remember their names, but she can remember the meeting.
The pitch was the Belfry number one, how well it had done. And that, oh yes, there was kind of time was of the essence here as well, that it was such a good investment that, and time was of the essence because it was closing at a particular date. I can't remember the dates. We're talking 20 years ago now.
The couple was persuaded to divert a chunk of Bernard's pension into Belfry 5. They paid the fees and signed the forms, but Bernard never even met the advisors. Michael O'Donoghue from County Cork also remembers being invited into his local AIB branch by the assistant manager for a chat about his personal finances. He owns a farm now, but back then he was involved in running a factory business.
I was shown upstairs and I had to wait because there was he was in a meeting. And the meeting went on for quite a long time. I couldn't believe it. But I heard some sobbing and so on inside in the room. And after quite a long time, these two people came out quite elderly. You'd know that they were very hard-working people. They were from the North Cork area. And I was ushered in.
The couple had been stung by another AIB scandal.
He said they were in the offshore scheme and they had to sell half their farm to cover the interest and penalties. And I asked him who sold them the offshore funds. And he said, it wasn't me anyhow, he said. It wasn't me.
Michael thought he was too careful for that. But then the Belfry prospectus landed in front of him. He was slowly won over.
There were three things, I suppose he said, that rang home. One was, it's a sure thing. Second thing was, if it doesn't make profit in the 8 years, we'll just roll it over, which was a lie. Maybe the guy didn't know it at the time, but it was a lie. And the third thing was, I asked him, because of the ordinary shares, and it does say that up to 4,999,900 ordinary shares would be issued. I assumed that it was a limited company with a shareholding. And if it was, I said, can we, if anything goes wrong, can we come back our half of that? And he didn't appear to know it, but he said, look, of course, if that's the situation, you can.
Michael put in €80,000. Ken put in €100,000. The Duggans, €150,000. And they weren't alone. By the mid-2000s, as many as 3,000 AIB customers had invested in Belfry. It was, in many ways, a sign of the times. Ireland was booming. The previous decade had seen the dawn of the Irish Financial Services Centre, big corporate tax breaks, and a wave of foreign direct investment into the country. Living standards were rising and house prices skyrocketed. This was the era of giveaway budgets and SSIA savings accounts. Ordinary people, many for the first time in their lives, had real money in their bank accounts. Banks, especially Anglo-Irish Bank, were cashing in with property deals for private clients. AIB also wanted in on the action, so it teamed up with a firm called Cheval to source commercial property portfolios across the UK. The bank marketed the deals to its wealthy clients, and then, increasingly, it began reaching out through its local branch managers to an ever wider base of customers. Ken says his bank manager told him he would double his money over 8 years.
I said, fantastic, because that's going towards my two lads' college fund, towards our retirement fund.
But that is not what happened.
Confirmed that the government has today decided that Ireland apply for financial assistance to the European Union. The request of the government was transmitted to the European authorities this evening.
We all know what happened next. Lehman Brothers, a large investment bank in the United States, collapsed in September 2008, triggering a global financial crisis. For nearly a decade, Ireland had been in the grips of property fever. When the bubble burst, Ireland's undercapitalised banks were exposed to massive losses. Unable to borrow in international markets, Irish banks began to topple. The country had to be bailed out by the Troika, and AIB was effectively nationalised. Belfry Fund investors were among the collateral damage.
2012, the year before it matured, we got a phone call from a young guy from some office of AIB to be told our fund is worth 18,000. We waited another year to be given a phone call again to say your fund is gone. The phone went down. That was it.
Belfry Funds 2-6 failed. But what do you do when your investment goes south?
Absolutely nothing. I did not know where to turn. Because we were all individuals. We weren't, there wasn't 1,200 of us as friends that bought into the Belfry in that particular year. We were all individuals. Then I got a call one day from a guy from Selbridge to say they're putting a little group of people together to try and find out what the hell went on.
There was ads in the newspapers. Back at the Irish Times, I think, I saw the advertisement and I said, you know, it was, were you unhappy with your Belfry investment? And there was a meeting arranged in the Red Cow Inn, which was, you know, there was hundreds of people. And I, looking round, and I see people from home all around me, you know, sort of, yeah, we were all in this.
For Belfry investor Edward Sheehan, this meeting was a turning point in what would become a David and Goliath struggle against AIB. Edward is a chartered accountant who had borrowed money to invest in the UK property fund. He was working for the Law Society when disgruntled investors began to organise. He later became chair of the Belfry Investor Action Group. It was a slow burner. Not much happened at the meetings at the start.
I think the first contribution we made, okay, there was a committee formed of, I think, about 10 people, okay, of which I was not part of. There were 10 people, and anybody that was interested, I think we gave them 100 euros to cover, if you like, the out-of-pocket expenses that had been incurred up to now in the paper advertisements and stuff like that.
As the group's numbers began to swell, the appetite for more radical action was growing, and that required deeper levels of organisation. Independent corporate finance house CKS came aboard to project manage the campaign. The investors group also started looking around for legal representation.
I'm Tom Casey. I'm a solicitor. I was the solicitor acting on behalf of the Belfry Investors Action Group, or the BIAG, as they call themselves, from 2014 up to the settlement of the litigation in 2021 and for a period of time thereafter. In fact, I'm probably still their solicitor, whether they want it or not.
Tom set up his own practice in 2008 and found himself floored busy in the recession years, acting against banks and vulture funds, and in cases involving failed investment products. Because of the nature of his work, he was contacted by the Action Group in 2014.
I got a call from an individual saying, would I meet, I think is my recollection now, it's 11 years ago, but I got a call from an individual, would I meet key parts of the committee, and we had a meeting in my office. I looked at the stuff. I took it home one weekend and I just read it. And they were looking at that time for an opinion from a barrister.
Tom Casey quickly came to the view that the Belfry investors had a case. He believed they had been missold an investment by AIB.
I would say less than 1% of the individuals involved were sophisticated investors here. There was a common theme running across each of the Belfry investments, and in fairness to the committee, one of the things they did was they got everyone who wanted to sign up to the BIAG to complete a little document which they prepared setting out which fund they had invested in. There were six Belfries, obviously five, one came good. Which fund they'd invested, how much they'd invested, and the manner in which it was sold to them and what had been said to them. And there was a theme running through each of those forms. Money lobbed into their bank account. They sold land, they got an inheritance, they lodged money with AIB. They were a long-standing customer of AIB in some cases in relation to it. And AIB approached them and said, we have this product, unsolicited in a lot of cases, cold calls. People actually literally turned up at business addresses in relation to it, turned up at the family home. No-brainer was a word that was used constantly. And it wasn't people coming together collectively and saying, you know, coming up with a story. No-brainer was a word that was used. This is how you make money. You don't have the money, we'll give you a loan.
In Tom's view, it was obvious that the bank had failed to explain to investors just how risky this product was.
So the reality is the bank handing over a 40-page prospectus to people saying, you know, well, you should have read this, and if you read it, you would have understood it. The reality is the first 10 pages are telling you what a brilliant product it is. You know, buried on page 45, or whatever page it was, risks, and even that doesn't explain to you.
It came down to gearing. What made the Belfry Fund so unsuitable to ordinary investors was how highly geared they were. Up to 80% of the funds were financed with senior debt from AIB. The balance was made up of investors' equity. That meant returns were amplified if UK commercial property values rose, but losses were also magnified if those values fell.
If something is making stellar returns like that, if it's that easy, we'd all be doing it. The reality is it's only making stellar returns because in this case, like a lot of the products being sold time, it's so highly geared. If you have, you know, you want to buy a property for 100 euro or it's been sold for 100 euro and you have 10 euro and you borrow 90 euro to buy it, okay, you don't own 10% of it. You own all of it. You just have a debt. Now, if I turn around to you and say, well, your 100 euro property, you're not getting a property worth 100 euro, by the way. You're paying stamp duty. You're paying fees. You're paying commission, you know, to make the investment. So it's not 100 euro you're getting, or it's not property value at 100 euro. It's property probably worth 90 euro.
In Belfry, AIB was both lender and distributor of the product. It earned interest on its loans while investors bore the equity risk. It was on both sides of the deal in a large number of cases. As a secured lender, the bank put in place loan-to-value covenants. If the property values fell and the ratio of debt-to-value hit a certain threshold, AIB could either ask investors to stump up more money, this is known as a margin call, to stop the loans going into default, or it could enforce its security and move to liquidate the assets.
Gearing. You know, it's how Sean Quinn lost all his money originally. It's very simply explained. It's like one analogy. Look, you want to invest in this product. Okay, if you're that crazy and you want to risk all your money, just like I'm telling you, the chances of you coming out with this at the end of your 8-year investment span with any money is slim and none. You want to take the risk, fine, sign here and hand over your check. But if I also can explain it to you by like, this is what you're investing in. You're handing over your 10 euro and you're taking 90 euro of the bank money to buy property that's probably only going to be worth 95 euro the day you buy it. And if it falls below to 92 euro, your property's gone.
Again, we all know the history. The market tanked in 2008, UK property prices fell, and the Belfry funds came crashing down.
The market did fall in the UK. They had invested in properties which were secondary. There's no other way to describe them. And in many cases, they required further investment. That further investment now dried up, decreasing the value of some of the properties. And you had the extraordinary situation where AIB itself was facing going bankrupt. And it was running out of money and it had to be bailed out by a state guarantee. It had dumped a lot of its assets, its worst assets, into NAMA.
The currency journalist Tom Lyons has covered the Belfry funds for more than a decade. He explains how the crash had AIB pinned by the collar. It urgently needed money.
And it was now looking at, well, what can we, how can we get money in? And it could see, well, here are these series of funds where there's still some value, particularly there's some value in as debt, as people collecting the debt, there's considerable value that we can get back most of our money here if we sell now, and we need that money. And we're not going to wait until the market cycle picks up again, because we need the money now, and we're going to get it. And if investors end up losing all of their money, which they all did, that's not our problem anymore. Even though we were very happy to court them on the way in, and now that the market conditions have changed, who cares?
Had AIB misled the Belfry investors by selling them an unsuitable investment product? Tom Casey believed it had. But turning that belief into an actionable lawsuit against a banking giant was a whole different story. There were two major issues. The first was money.
Tom was willing to walk for nothing until the finality. But the barristers would not, because they took the view, OK, we're doing this, we have to get paid up front. If we lose, we're never going to get paid.
Everybody had to stump up cash if they wanted to take the fight to AIB. Some of the aggrieved investors had little choice but to drop out. They just couldn't afford to continue.
In the meantime, we were paying every couple of months 1,000 here, 1,000 there. And over a lot of the meetings, I had met some very, very sad people who had paid. I paid in 100,000, but there was people who paid in 2, 3, 4, half a million and lost everything.
Others, like Edward, were ready and able to fight on. He was already on the hook to AIB for €150,000 he had borrowed to invest in Belfry 4. Litigation for him was a strategic gamble to try to win back what he had lost.
8,500, I think, was the total that we put in. That's a 20-1 bet, is the way I looked at it. I'm putting in 8,000 to win 150. In bookkeeping terms, or in bookie terms, okay, that's a good bet.
But money was just one problem. The second major issue was the statute of limitations. In Ireland, you typically have 6 years to bring forward a contractual dispute and certain tortious claims of negligence and wrongdoing, everything from damage to property and trespassing to unpaid debt claims. If you don't act within that time, you run a high risk of having your case thrown out as statute barred.
The statute of limitations says you have 6 years for breach of contract or negligence, unless it's fraudulently concealed from you that you have a cause of action. So let's keep it simple, you have 6 years. So if it's 6 years from the date of wrong, it's 6 years from the date you made your investment when you didn't get what you thought you were getting. So it's 6 years from December 2006, which brings you up to December 2012. If you haven't issued a summons by December 2012, on one view in life, you're gone, you're finished. So what is the other key date? The date I realise I didn't get what I paid for.
For AIB, this was crucial. Its first line of defence was simple but devastating, that the claims of the Belfry investors were out of time. The fight over the statute of limitations was costly, complex and heavily contested. It dragged on for years, going all the way to the Supreme Court. If investors lost, it was game over. They would walk away with nothing. The ruling finally came in December 2020, in the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic. It barely made headlines. Yet it was a massive victory. After 6 grueling years, the Belfry investors had won the right to fight on.
I got 2 judgments actually at the same time, that Christmas period. It was a great Christmas. We got the Belfry Supreme Court decision. I think on a Friday, the toy show was on that evening. So we had a great evening, I have to say, in relation to it. And then, then you're in, you're back into court looking for directions and you're preparing for a 6-8 week trial. I can't remember what it was at the time.
That was the problem. Like, you only won the right to go back to the High Court. And what they were doing then was they were taking an 83-year-old lady, putting her on the stand as the case for mis-selling, whose husband had been sold the product while he was terminally ill.
That woman was Bernadette Goodwin. Unlike the United States or the pages of a John Grisham novel, Ireland doesn't really have a system of class actions where individuals can unite to take on a corporation with one big lawsuit. The law is slowly beginning to change, but back in 2014, Tom Casey had to file hundreds of summonses on behalf of the individual Belfry investors. To make the legal action more manageable, AIB picked a number of test cases said to be representative of the wider group. These would go to hearing and set the path for all the others who followed. There was pushback over the bank's selection, but ultimately the parties agreed on 8 of these Pathfinder cases, 6 chosen by AIB and 2 chosen by the investors. But which would go first?
Ultimately, the court, because the thing was going on for so long after we won at the Supreme Court, the court agreed that there would be one test case that would ultimately proceed. It was our test case and it was Bernadette. And we convinced the court to do that primarily, to be blunt about it, because of Bernadette's age at the time.
Bernadette had in many respects an ordinary life for a woman of her generation. She worked up until the time she got married to Charles. He was a successful businessman and they had a family together. Charles had fallen into ill health after he retired, and he was trying to organise his affairs so Bernadette and the family would be comfortable after he passed away. As part of that arrangement, he had met with AIB and he had been advised to invest in Belfry.
Charles was sold the investment at a meeting. He died a month later. He was in extreme ill health. Bernadette had a recollection of what had gone on, but she deferred to Charles as regards most investment decisions at the time that he made, including the decisions he was making when he was in ill health.
Bernadette believed strongly that Charles would not have invested in Belfry if he had thought the product was extremely high risk and would not have come good.
She had a view in relation to it, and she felt very strongly that she needed to go forward with the case, frankly, I suppose you could say, in honour of his memory. And she was very brave to put herself forward in relation to it. We had a discussion with her about, her exposure in relation to it, because ultimately if there's a cost order, it ain't a cost order against Joe Bloggs, it ain't a cost order against Tom Casey, it's a cost order against Bernadette Goodwin. And she and her family needed to be convinced that ultimately, she wasn't going to be made bankrupt out of this.
Even though Bernadette was willing to take on the challenge, Tom Casey had reservations right up to the last minute, knowing that Bernadette would be grilled in the witness box by AIB's lawyers.
When Gary and John, our counsel, sat down to meet with Bernadette just a few days before she was given evidence, and we were wondering, literally, can we actually put this woman through it? And that's absolutely no disrespect to her. I'm not talking down to her anyway, but you are looking at a lady who's at a certain age. I don't know if you've ever met Bernadette, but she's very petite, she's very proper, and, she's very funny. But you realise, do you realise what you're putting yourself in for?
The case was due to start in July 2021, but it never went ahead. Instead, AIB settled on the steps of the court.
The settlement came about because the counsel for AIB, when the case started, literally started, the barristers stand up and introduce themselves to the judge, Judge Amore, I think, and counsel for AIB asked the court, could the court rise for a few minutes? And the court rose, and then discussions started within the barristers and continued throughout the day and include for the next few days. Obviously, the complicating factor here for us was we had, they didn't want just the Bernadette case to settle. There was no point in that settling, and then the next case in the line. So everything needed to settle, and that ultimately was a complicating factor because there was a precondition on the settlement that we bring all the investors home in relation to it.
7 years after the writs were served, it was all over. The Belfry investors had taken on the bank and had a €25 million settlement to show for it. That was what AIB agreed to hand over to put 272 cases to bed and cover the legal bill. In return, the investors dropped mis-selling claims against the bank. As chair of the Belfry Investors Action Group, Edward had to fight to get the deal over the line.
So I had to address them on 3 or 4 occasions, or 3 or 4 meetings, okay. And I said that I have read thousands of litigation files in my work, okay. And who was to know what falling off a ladder is worth? But I said, there's people here that know what falling off a ladder is worth. Senior counsel, junior counsel, they know what the value of litigation is. And I said, they are telling you that this is the best deal, that this is a good deal, this is the best deal. In fact, it's the only deal you'll get.
Under the terms of the settlement, the Belfry investors would only recoup a percentage of their investment. But it was enough money to make some investors who had bailed out of the litigation on the road to court now try to jump aboard again.
You had a lot of people coming out of Roodork saying, where's my check? I was part of the group. And we say, well, actually, you weren't. You dropped out. You didn't make a contribution. You had people saying, well, I attended a meeting back in 2014. I always thought I was in the group. And I'm saying, well, I've never heard of you.
It had been a long and hard-won fight for the 272 investors who crossed the line. One that generates mixed feelings even now, as Ken Hannigan explains.
It's a great Irish thing that a group of people like that stuck together all that way. I think it was... like, there was tears, there was sadness, there was smiles, and especially when we got to the steps of the court, and we probably should not have accepted that at the time. We should have said, no, we're not accepting it, we're going into court. And I always wonder what would have happened. But we accepted the 46,000. And that was like hush money, just go on. But I would like to have seen, we should have been stronger at that stage and say, no, let's go into court.
Obviously, you're happy. I was happy for the clients in relation to it. I was happy for the team. I was happy for myself. And it was a huge relief to get it finished with. Now, obviously, we knew there was going to be issues thereafter, and it transpired there was. But I have to say, I got more satisfaction in winning the Supreme Court. Maybe it was because it was Christmas or whatever. I don't know.
The struggle was over. But only Belfry investors with the money and determination to go to court had anything to show for it. What about the remaining Belfry investors who were not compensated in the legal settlement? They too lost everything, only they had got nothing in return. In part two of Belfry, we continue our investigation. We follow the push that forced AIB into a wider redress scheme.
Why would they not have told us there's going to be a redress scheme during 8 years of litigation? Actually, why would they not have just given people their money back?
The investors' fight for compensation should have been over.
There must be some way out of this. They must, because, you know, it was a terrible vehicle, a terrible pension vehicle.
In fact, it was only beginning. Belfry is a Currency Media production recorded at Beacon Studios, written and edited by Francesca Cummin, produced by Ian Keogh, with music by Philip Stewart.